Welcome back to Newlands Cricket Ground, and it's lunchtime on the second day, and it has been a most entertaining morning's play that we've seen for a long, long time, and all that led by the likes of Stokes and also Bairstow, who've fashioned a partnership of 230 and they've virtually taken the game away from South Africa. What's more interesting is how well Stokes has performed today. He is the second fastest 100 in world cricket and also the fastest by an Englishman. And we've just got confirmation that Nathan Astle, the New Zealander, in that sensational match against England, when Thorpe, in fact, first scored the went beyond or quicker than Gilchrist to register a fastest double 100. In that same match, Nathan Astle went and batted it. It was quite a sensational match. That was, and now we've seen something quite special from Ben Stokes. Also, what is important to mention is that there haven't been too many batsmen in the history of Test cricket that have actually scored 100 within a session. And this is a two-hour session. It wasn't an extended one. And he was overnight not out on 74, pardon me, and went on to now, as I said, register not just the 100, the 150, but also the double, and he's just provided fantastic entertainment for all of those watching and, of course, listening on Radio 2000. And when the declaration will be coming is obviously going to be the big question that all of those interested in watching and listening to this test mess will be asking. And my feeling is that England will be batting way through till tea time. There's just too much time in the match. They also know that this is a very placid pitch, having played that way from the first day, and that the only way they will be able to pressure a very good South African batting team when it does come off is to have a huge score. I'm sure 600 plus is what they'll be aiming for. And South Africa, well, how will they be able to curtail this damage? That's also left to be seen. But with me for this lunchtime chat, I have a very interesting guest. In fact, two of them. One is André Odendaal, the former CEO of Western Province Cricket, Professor André Odendaal, also a writer and historian. And he's written a few books on his own. But and he's going to be helping me along because he's written the foreword to what is a very interesting book. I saw somewhere on Twitter also described as an intriguing book that Dean Allen has written. He's our guest, and this is his first attempt, and I must say that from having just paged through the book itself, it looks like a fascinating a narrative and a history of South Africa, of cricket in South Africa, and how it in fact came and evolved with the British in the early part of their sojourn into Africa and the Cape Colony to start with. Well, welcome, gentlemen, and great to have both of you in the Radio 2000 studios.
Thank you, Aslam. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
André, welcome.
Thanks very much, Aslam. It's lovely to be a spectator watching such good cricket.
Yeah, no more with the responsibility of a CEO.
Stresses and strains, but it's, Evan Flynn's done a fantastic job. Nabil Dean and his team. I haven't seen the stadium look so beautiful, so they've really done well, and to fit in the crowds is wonderful for cricket.
Yeah, indeed. Now let's focus on Dean and his book, Empire, War and Cricket in South Africa. And he's obviously just completed this book, and interestingly, it's also been shortlisted for the Non-Fiction Book of the Year 2015. So congratulations to start off with. Dean, welcome, as I said. And let's get right to the beginning. Tell us about yourself. And then, what was the motivation? What sparked this something special in you to write about Mikey's Fontein of all places, which I never heard of until I saw the cover of your book?
Well, it's been quite a journey. As you can probably hear from my accent, I'm English originally, but I consider myself almost South African now. I arrived in the mid-90s, and I went on to do a master's degree and a PhD at Stellenbosch University. So to be back here at Newlands, which is, in my opinion, the greatest cricket ground in the world, I mean, what a pleasure. Obviously, I've got a foot in both camps, so at the moment I'm English. The book has been quite a journey. It's a product of 10 years of study. I finished my PhD in 2008, which the book came from. But I knew this was going to be too good of a story to just be an academic tome. So we turned it into this wonderful book. Penguin South Africa got hold of it. And, of course, Mikey's Fontein runs throughout it. I mean, this wonderful place of South African heritage and folklore that a lot of people, you know, have heard of or been to. There's a song about it. There's poems and there's ghost stories, etc. So I went along in the late 90s as a tourist. And I'd heard
this
about
is to Mikey's
to Mikey's Fontaine in the Karoo, which is 2.5 hours outside of Cape Town, 8 hours by the train. And I'd heard about the cricket connection, how the first English cricket teams had played at this unlikely place. And then I started digging, and this incredible story came to light. And as I said, from the PhD, this book has emerged, which has captured the imagination here in South Africa. I've now moved back to the UK to take a position at Bournemouth University, but I'm back here often giving book talks. And of course, there's as much relevance of this story in the United Kingdom with its British Empire and the central figure being a Scotsman, that in Britain it's starting to engage with people, and certainly now with the South Africa and England tour, it really has relevance. It's fascinating to be able to tell the story of how cricket arrived in this country.
It's amazing how cricket has this common thread. I've just recently read a book written by award-winning author in England, and he also wrote the book on Basil de Oliveira, O'Bourne, his first name, Peter O'Bourne. And Peter O'Bourne traces the history of cricket in Pakistan. And as you read it, he naturally delves into the rich history of the subcontinent itself before partition. And naturally, having written cricket stories before and the book on Basil, he focused so much on that. And then the common thread running through that was how cricket, through the British and the annexation and also being in that part of the world for such a long time, how it took root, and now we know where it is on the subcontinent, in both India, Pakistan, and of course you can add Bangladesh and Sri Lanka to that as well. And then the story is very similar here, and it's not dissimilar in the West Indies, where historians have actually covered the common thread of cricket. And I just find it fascinating that here's this one sport that actually becomes so central to so much of and surrounded so much by the history of those particular countries that I've mentioned. Coming to South Africa, and before I get Andre in there as well, because Andre Odendaal has actually written the foreword to your book, you've given us the motivation. In fact, I want to go in this order: empire, war, and cricket. Let's start with Mr. Logan himself, James Douglas Logan, and the interest that he captured with the people in Cape Town, and then he, in fact, started off in Cape Town and then moved into Mikey's Fontaine. And how did cricket then evolve then? How did he gain all of the riches that he did? And he was so much a community leader that part of the narrative itself is absolutely fascinating. And it gives a perfect indication of how settlers got into South Africa, Southern Africa in his case, and made such a huge difference to the locals. Obviously, they gained in business and made lots of money. But there were great advantages to the locals as well.
Well, James Logan was termed the ideal colonial. He arrived in 1877 as a 19-year-old working class Scot, and by the age of 25, he's a millionaire in modern terms, and he's built his in English terms, in pound terms, and he's built his own empire out at Mikey's Fontaine. But it goes beyond that. Of course, cricket arrived with the early settlers in the early 1800s. It mm-hmm. played here, but what it needed was individuals like this man with the means and the motivation behind him to bring international sport down here. So there's no surprise. Diamonds had just been discovered in Kimberley. Logan arrived just at the right time. He made his fame and fortune very quickly. A lot of it was a smokescreen. People believe he made his money on the railways. He had quite a lucrative business in the refreshment catering facilities in a lot of the railways up towards Zimbabwe, Rhodesia as it were at the time. But what he needed was to buy influence. Remember, he was a working class Scot. He found fame and fortune here, so what better way to buy into this empire game, which was the game of cricket? And in the first tour that came down, of course, 1889, Major Wharton's tour, he wanted to be involved. He saw the impact that had, and in 1891, the second ever English team came down, Walter Reed's team, and Logan was the benefactor. He was the sponsor behind that, so it was about as much about money as it is now. But in those days, it was an amateur game. So these people operated behind the scenes, and for Logan, interestingly enough, he sponsored that second English tour, and he didn't get his money back with interest. I've got the wonderful dialogue between him and the English cricket establishment, agreeing on the terms of the tour, and because the tour wasn't a success financially. financially. Logan, fantastic story in the book, one of my favourites, had the English captain and manager arrested as they boarded their ship back to sail back to England. And he actually sued them for £857 in damages. It made him a household name here in the Cape. And he went on then, of course, to be a political mover and shaker, very allied to Cecil Rhodes. He wanted to be involved in the first ever South African tour in 1894. We talked off air about the interesting story about Crom Hendricks, and then we have these deeper kind of themes that run throughout the book. I mean, Crom Hendricks, the fast bowler here in the Cape, the Cape Malay player, couldn't be selected according to Rhodes because of his colour, and that was back in 1894. Mm-hmm. Later he describes his dilemma to Pelham Warner, Rhodes, and he says, "My hands were tied. As much as I wanted to select the player of ability, I could not have a player of colour representing South Africa." And this was in 1894. And interestingly enough, his reason was because the English would have him throwing boomerangs during the lunch interval back in the UK, because the first ever tour that came across from Australia were a team of Aborigines, and it became this kind of racial circus. So there was absolutely fascinating themes at this time, and we can learn so much from this period that teaches us what came later in South African history.
That also tells you about the other common thread, that wherever cricket went, wherever the colonists did go, there was the element of racism, whether you were in India, in the West Indies, or even in the southern tip of Africa. The first ever test match, Andre, you can come in here, took place in Port Elizabeth in 1887, was it?
Yeah, 1889 actually, so that season. And
now, the question I wanted to just ask is if James Logan was involved in the second tour, how did the first one evolve, just from a historic point of view?
Also by people
benefactors
trying to make money, and also benefactors. So as Dean has said,
money is the other central theme.
I mean, James Logan was a modern, you know, in the worst sense, a tenderpreneur and a cowboy capitalist. At a time when British people were coming in after golds and diamonds to make millions. In fact, the Cape Times wrote, "It's time we sent a team to South Africa, to England, and not just millionaires back home." So people were just coming in here, making money, obviously, often through dubious means, like Rhodes and them cornering the whole diamond claims in Kimberley and so on. And as Dean has nicely put, cricket then becomes a way of getting respect in society for a working class Scotsman and for promoting yourself and so on. So there's a tremendously close link between the growth of stinkingly wealthy people after diamonds and gold and the growth of cricket. Cricket became almost tied to Rhodes, and Rhodesia was formed with six of the first 10 South African cricket captains finding employment in there. So that was part of the process of conquest and colonialism. And the Logan Cup in Zimbabwe came from the same Logan. So they were all tied in. It was all connected people taking the advantages and growing this game, unfortunately, in a very British imperialist way rather than a South African way that opened up and was more inclusive. And that included excluding Afrikaners, which is why today it only happened in the 60s and particularly after democracy in the 90s that Afrikaners came through. But what I'd like to say is, listening to Dean, for a book to work, you need passion and you need a certain obsession. And, you know, he's brought
10
it
years in
he's
in
brought it into this thing. He's virtually South African. He loves he loves Matthies Fontein, but he's worked very hard on this. And this adds another one of 10 or so books that have started showing us aspects of this past. There are two other parts that I'd like you to perhaps ask him to speak about a little.
Well, he's our guest.
Nation building, how cricket then, after the South African War, the old Anglo-Boer Wars, it was called, how nation building, similar to us today, becomes important in cricket. And you've already alluded to it in terms of the racism of the late 19th century British. They thought themselves superior to anyone in the world, never mind black people who they'd colonized and conquered. And the whole issue of merit, because Logan's son played for South Africa and he was sponsoring the tour, and he was obviously not by any standards like a great cricketer, you know, if you look around you today. So that whole thing of merit just didn't exist. It was class-based kind of privilege that mm-hmm. got you there. And today, the same people who benefited from it are talking about create merit here mm-hmm. without recognizing that we need to restructure mm-hmm. In a very fundamental way a game that has been built on prejudice and institutional inequality for 100 years. So it teaches us lessons for today. And Dean, mm-hmm. If you could speak a bit on nation building and merit, would be very interesting.
Well, thank you for those kind words, Andre. Yes, I certainly am passionate about this subject. I mean, it was a book that needed to be written. I mean, Logan is one of those characters that history has missed. Not that he would have achieved what he had done if he had stayed in the United Kingdom, but there would have been dozens of books about this guy, maybe even a movie. I mean, it's a fantastic film script. But what Logan wanted to achieve, of course, was build his own empire. And you alluded to him picking his own son. I mean, one of the most incredible parts of the story was James Logan's ambition was to really influence the game back in the old country. And he mm-hmm. wanted to take his own South African team back to the UK. He did so in 1901, right in the middle of the South African War. Mm-hmm. The South African Cricket Association.
There was a big opposition to that as well.
Of course, yeah. The South African Cricket Association had disbanded because, you know, you don't play sport when war was taking place. The far greater game, as they called it. And Logan took that opportunity. By now, he'd made friends with a chap called Lord Hawke in the corridors of the MCC, mm-hmm. this aristocratic Yorkshireman who'd come down with the third and fourth English cricket teams in the 1890s. And he arranged this tour. As you said, Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, no less, writes mm-hmm. in the press, how dare this team arrive when they should be fighting a war mm-hmm. back in their own country. Logan, the great publicist that he was, turned the whole thing around, said that he'd served in the war, as a lot of his team had done, and they were darlings of the British press as well. So this man made news, you know, both here in the colonies of Southern Africa, but back throughout the British Empire, in fact. And that's why it's so significant, you know, regardless of the likes of Rhodes, etc. But to go on to Andre's question about nation building, the war especially, I'm very interested in that aspect of how the South African War, it was a South African War, it wasn't a white man's war, it affected everybody in this country. Mm-hmm. How sport was shaped after that. Of course, cricket had always had that English connotation. We know through Andre's work and others that it was the African game. I mean, everybody played this game, mm-hmm. but the English controlled cricket, especially after the war. Whereas the Afrikaners took rugby and made Afrikanerized it. They made it their sport. And this was shaped after this conflict. So we're kind of still in a legacy of this bitter three-year conflict. Even today, when we see certain population groups identify themselves with South African sport, and as you rightly said earlier, a lot of my work is focused on sport throughout the wider British Empire. We see the same patterns and the same themes happening elsewhere. But the challenge for me, of course, was to get right down to the grassroots of this and find individuals like James Logan, who were the people who drove this process. At my PhD Viva a few years ago, a rather tough examination by three history professors, mm-hmm. but one gave me the compliment of saying, I've done something unique here. I've taken an individual, but I've brought in the wider themes of imperialism, empire, and, mm-hmm. and politics. And that's what the title suggests, Empire, War and Cricket. They were all tied in together.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've sort of almost delved on the surface, but had it not been for James Logan, I think there probably wouldn't have been enough material. I must say the book in itself is a magnificent print. There's unbelievable photographs in there. I mean, that's the first thing you do when you get into a book is to study that. And there's a story in each one, and you could write one about each of those. So that's one of the features, and whoever goes out to buy this, I think, will really appreciate it. But that extraordinary man, we've described him as maybe some sort of a visionary as well. How does, I've written it down here, how does he feature, and why is it that Mikey's Fontein itself becomes such an important narrative in what you've written here?
Well, here in
it's part of your title.
Of course, Logan of Mikey's Fontein. I mean, here in South Africa, it's a place I don't often have to describe because, as I said, I give talks all around the country, and the majority of the room would have heard or have visited the place. Mm-hmm. But back in the United Kingdom, it represents something else. When you first walk down its street, it really is a legacy or a product of the British British Empire. It was built to last as such. And the guy behind it, what he wanted to do, its location is key. He wanted to create something where other people hadn't created anything. And in fact, he rather modestly turned down the offer of renaming the village, because there was a railway siding there to start off with called Mikey's Fontaine. Someone suggested they change the name to Logansville, but I saw
that in the book.
Yeah, Logan said, it's not that I have created so much, others have created so little in this area. So, mm-hmm. I mean, he knew how to play the media, but the place itself, it was his own empire. And it was written about around the English-speaking world. I mean, a lot of my sources come from Canada, Australia, the West Indies. They talk about this man who created something where no one else had built anything. He was known as the ideal colonial. And add to the fact that he was bringing the English cricket teams down here as well. Mm-hmm. He was known as a tremendous sportsman, you know, and he who would question his motives or how he made his money? So it was almost the smokescreen, and it was part of the folklore that built up around him. And of course, it makes for a fantastic read in the book. And the Logan family archives, I've got access to them for the first time, so there's incredible historical documents within this book as well.
Mm-hmm. Another way of putting it, in addition to what Dean has said, is that today it's the guys on the information highway that are making the money. Mm-hmm. But Mikey's Fontein was a key part of the unfolding railway link to Johannesburg.
That's right. And further up into Zimbabwe. Yeah.
So within 15 years, Johannesburg was the richest. A quarter of the world's gold was being produced in Johannesburg within 15 years of its founding. And a key part of exploiting those resources was to get the railway to Johannesburg. So the first English tour in 1888-89, they went by coach from Kimberley to Joburg because there wasn't a railway line. And very quickly a railway line was built there so that this heavy machinery that could go into the deepest mines and be sent.
Transported.
And he was sitting with the trading the concession to cater. As soon as you got very thirsty in the middle of the Karoo, stopped at Logan's Siding.
Well, that's where he started making his money, according to what I've read. But Dean, before you come in, and I know you want to add something more interesting, I just made a note here. By 1892, 5,000 sheep on his farms, and then he also formed the waterworks, because being in the Karoo, that was possibly one of the most difficult things to do if you wanted to evolve and create a town and start living there. And so the waterworks was quite interesting with those boreholes. Then he purchased and owned 7,700 acres of land, and he bought it at £400. And as you said, the early focus of his business and entrepreneurship was the refreshment and catering concessions shops or stops all along the railway lines, up to Johannesburg. Right, were going to come in?
No, very much so. I mean, remember, the railway was the key to the continent, as Rhodes says. I mean, Mikey's Fontein was built upon the railway network. Now, James Logan, as you said, incredible figures there. I mean, he arrived in South Africa just at the right time. Mm-hmm. Yes, he was an entrepreneur and an opportunist, but he was also very fortunate in terms of timing. Mm-hmm. He went from days, his early days of being a porter at Cape Town Station, newly built station, to becoming the station master, then district superintendent of the Karoo region. He had some experience of the Scottish Railways, even as a young man, so that put him in good stead. But a lovely story to do with the refreshment facilities, and of course, being a PhD, I couldn't speculate. What's in the book, I believe, is true. But a lovely story I had to include it was the story of the hot soup. Now, being a Scotsman, I mean, Scotsmen are quite noted for being careful with their funds. Now, James Logan, it was said, would serve his soup so hot that people would not have time to finish the soup before the train would leave. So it would go back into the pot to be served another day, which is fantastic. but he was clearly some character, and he understood the media, which was the written word at that time. He even owned his own newspaper, the Worcester Chronicle. So the news that came out was good news. So he was a media man. He understood that. Which kind of preempts a lot of what we see in sport today. And of course, when the war came out, he also offered the facilities at Mikey's Fontein to the British forces. So even then, he was the ideal colonial. I mean, Queen Victoria thanks him for his efforts during the war. He was awarded the rank of major by these famous soldiers that are now staying at his newly completed hotel. So the war especially sort of encapsulates what was happening. Now, after the war, of course, Abe Bailey steps in and takes over the mantle as South Africa's foremost benefactor. But Logan's legacy survives. He brought those early tours down. And as Andre rightly said, the Logan Cup is still played for today in Zimbabwe, which is amazing. And now somebody has come along. Ironically, this Englishman from the West Country and has written this fantastic story about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you what, I'm looking forward to reading more about it. Dean, before you go, because the ground's just been cleared, and I'm sure well, there's no declaration, so the two batsmen, Stokes and Bairstow, will be coming out to continue their hammering of the South African attack on this bright, sunny Cape Town afternoon. You've been giving a few talks around the country after this publication. You still have a few more to go. There is a website that our listeners could tap into to get some dates and also venues. Give it to us.
Yeah, no, fantastic. I'd be delighted to. I'm actually coming back in March and April, and it's like a countrywide tour. I'm up in Johannesburg, I'm down in East London, and obviously here in the Cape. And if listeners would like to go to my website, which is www.deanallen.co.za, they can find out more details of my talk. And that's when really I bring this story to life, and with all the images, and it's a fantastic evening as well. So I'd like to engage with people through this story.
I'm sure it'll be a fascinating experience for those who can make it. So remember, you can go to Dean's website, deanallen.co.za, and you can pick up all of those dates for the future tours that he will be doing around the country. You're saying you're going back to the UK, coming back in March?
I am. Fortunately enough, I'm around for the Johannesburg test, so I go up to the Wanderers, and then I fly back to the dark and cold on January the 20th. So I'm looking forward to coming back in March.
Well, we wish you luck with your book. It's been fascinating. I promise you that I will read through it, and I'm sure I'll be gaining quite a bit out of this, but it's magnificently illustrated, and some of the most fascinating pictures. Andre will tell you before we in fact leave that his motivation has always been about the history of cricket in South Africa, and now he's actually busy putting something together there as well. He motivated me to write the history of Transvaal cricket that was in the non-racial period, and I had to produce something in a period of 4 months.
Wow.
And that was quite a challenge, but I was certainly helped along by Andre as well. And so there's so much to be said, and I know Australia have written a history about Australian cricket. I think there's one been published about is it Meher Bose?
India. Ramachandra Guha as well, and then Michael Manley, the former president of
Barbados.
No, of Jamaica.
Jamaica
has
yeah.
written a history of West Indies cricket. So the last general history of South African cricket was written in 1915, with two books following up to 47. And that's what we're busy with now, trying to do a three-volumed history that retells, with the knowledge that we have from the perspective of today, the entire history of a colonial game.
When do you anticipate that rolling into publication, Andre?
Volumes 1 and 2, hopefully in October this year, and then volume 3, which covers the period 55 to today. The building of unity out of those divisions of the past would follow in 2017.
Fantastic. It's been great to have you guys. Dean, you want to add something?
No, I'm just saying it's a privilege to have worked with people like Andre, because, I mean, to come here as a Brit in the mid-90s with the archives opening up, as it were, and to make a contribution like Andre and hopefully myself has done to the sporting history, but the social history of this country, has been an absolute privilege.
Yeah, and I think we all empathize, we all see through the same keyhole. Well, fantastic. It's been great having you, Professor Andre Odendaal, and also Dean Allen. We wish you both gentlemen luck with all of your endeavors, and great success with your book, Empire, War and Cricket in South Africa. Dean Allen's the writer. It's been our pleasure having him on Radio 2000. We're going to take a short break.